Hey, what's going on, guys? Welcome to DrBoyceTV.com, the home for intelligent black people. I thought I would kind of do like a Uncle Boyce talk tonight about investing and just kind of share some thoughts that were on my mind today. I was in the car and I was listening to something on CNBC. CNBC had a special about the rise in gambling culture. That took place during the pandemic. During the pandemic, there was really there were a lot of depressed people and a lot of people looking for something to do, not just depressed, but also just bored. And they really got into gambling. Gambling became legal in a lot of different states. And companies like DraftKings really took off. And there's been a lot of wagering kind of happening online. And I'm not here really to make a judgment call about it. I just wanted to kind of talk about it a little bit and just kind of give you a perspective, just kind of a way to kind of think about it, because a lot of people have made the tragic mistake of thinking that gambling is the same as investing. They think they're investing and they say, look at me, I'm investing. And I say, actually, you're kind of speculating. So by the way, if you could, let me know if you can hear me. Give me a yes if you can hear me. I'm using a different kind of microphone. I want to make sure I'm coming through okay. And so if you can hear me, just give me a yes or a loud and clear or something. Let me know. So I know I'm not talking to myself. I was a little bit irritated because today I was on Instagram and I was talking and nobody could hear me. And I don't know why. I literally had no idea why. OK, thank you, Adam and Jamar and Rohan. All right. So I'm just going to this is really just more of a casual kind of, you know, stream of consciousness. So I hope that's OK, guys. I'm literally actually playing Call of Duty with my son, but I wanted to do the stream of consciousness to talk about this investing and gambling thing. So here's what drove this discussion and what made me wanted to have this talk with you. So I was listening to this thing and they were talking about how so many people, you know, during the pandemic, because there were so many mental health issues going on and these were unaddressed. Nobody's really talking about the mental health crisis that took place during the pandemic. They only talk about, you know, the 0.2% of the population that died, most of whom were senior citizens, but they don't talk about the impact it had on young people. You know, a lot of our young people were really harmed by the pandemic psychologically. They lost their youth. You know, we have a 17-year-old and the poor kid, you know, I don't know about y'all, but I had, you know, I remember my senior year of high school was like, you know, a pretty big deal. Like I was graduating, I was running track, you know, I got my first girlfriend. Had sex for the first time. You know, I had a lot of experiences, you know, around my senior year that, you know, a lot of young people lost, you know, and I felt really bad for them. And so as a result of this, because you had young people were having to come home from college and stuff like that, you had a lot of depression. You know, you had a lot of people that were experiencing severe mental health consequences from the pandemic. And, you know, shout it out if you have a young person in your household where you notice that they just, you know, they just didn't understand what was going on. So long story short, here's the deal. So I was, one thing that occurred during the pandemic that maybe media isn't talking about enough or not talking about it in the right way, in my view, is that you had a real big surge in gambling activity. A lot of young people started gambling online. And the gambling was, not so much traditional gambling. It was different because it could be done on the internet, you know, kind of anonymously. And also it was done in a way that was a little more covert because, you know, instead of going down to the casino, like in the old days, you know, where you go down there and people know clearly that you're down there doing something that you shouldn't do too much of. It was done through like apps like Robinhood. Like Robinhood gamified investing, which to some extent, I think it was good because it did create more investors, which you guys know, I've been talking for years about the importance of investing and how critical that is to your economic future. But when you gamify it, you kind of create the wrong incentives. You know, it's like introducing somebody. Let me give you an example of how the wrong incentives can make something, you know, make a decision of the right decision into the wrong one. I had a homeboy one time, right? Check this out. When I was 25 years old, true story. I hadn't seen him for a while, but he was like that crazy cousin. You know, everybody got that crazy friend that you know, if you hang out with that person too much, you're going to get locked up or killed. And so I didn't really hang out with this dude too much But he, you know, but we were cool because we grew up together. So he came to my house and out of the blue when we were like in our mid 20s, and he had converted. He'd become a Muslim. And he was and he was going to take on like two wives or something because he went to the Middle East, became a Muslim. And he was like, and so check this out. So he was trying to convert me to Islam. And I wasn't really interested. I was just trying to like graduate. Like I was like, dude, I'm not trying to, you know, get into whatever your latest little thing is. I'm trying to just stay in school and graduate, you know, because I want to have a good future. And so so check this out. So here's how he recruited me to Islam. I swear to God, this is what he was saying. He was saying, you know, if you you can have two wives and they have to have sex with you, like they can't tell you no. And and I remember even at 25, you know, like even as a horny 25-year-old, I remember thinking, like, is that all you can tell me? Is that all you can talk about is the fact that, you know, that my wife has to have sex with me and that she can't tell me no? Like there's nothing else about Islam that comes to mind for you other than the fact that you get unlimited amounts of vagina? Like, really, dude? You know, and so in a way, that's what makes me think about, you know, this whole investing versus gambling thing is, yeah, there is kind of the high of making money, and sometimes you can make that money real fast, but that's not really what it's always about. And that's not how investing usually works, right? And so it became really hard for people like me to even consider having these discussions during the pandemic, because in the pandemic, you literally had an environment of investing and money that was made at a rate faster than I'd ever seen in my life. Like I'd never, ever seen like that much money made that quickly. Like I never saw quality companies like, you know, Apple and Tesla or GM, like going up, you know, 40, 50% in 1 year and all this other stuff, right? So in the pandemic, you had a unique opportunity to make insane amounts of money. And a lot of people came into that and it became like a gambling culture because Robinhood had gamified it. It became like a game. You know, I would hear people talk about investing and they would say, okay, here's our plays for today. Here's the investing plays we're going to make today, right? And I would be like, you sound like, you know, like you're running the numbers, right? And I'm not knocking it, right? I get that. I understand lotteries are fun. Gambling is fun. Bingo is fun. Games are fun. But your family's economic future, to me, it ain't really a game like that. You know what I mean? It's not a game when you're talking about trying to build generational wealth and break generational curses and have assets for your children. I wouldn't get too caught up in the gaming culture because here's the thing. A lot of these people who are in this gaming culture now, they're going to be gone as soon as investing gets for real. Like once investing gets real and you're making your money, not, you know, 30% of the time, instead you're making it, you know, 2% in 1 year or whatever, those people are going to really have a hard time. You know, they pretty much have like, unfortunately, you can get hooked on these fixes, right? These fixes are, oh my God, I bought Shiba Inu and it doubled in a day. And now my money, you know, now I've got thousands of dollars more than what I had before. And really investing in quality companies and all that, it doesn't really work that way. It just doesn't. You know, and so anyway, do me a favor, hit the thumbs up button, share, subscribe button if you haven't done it yet. Also, let me know if you can hear me. Give me a yes or no if you can hear me in the chat. I want to make sure you guys can hear me okay. So investing, that just this past year is not what investing is. It's just not like that typically, you know. And so I'm really curious to see what's going to happen, you know, when everything kind of cools off and slows down. Here's what I predict. Think of regular investing like drinking Kool-Aid. Like think of it like Kool-Aid, right? So you have some kids. Have you ever had? I was like this, right? I grew up. Did y'all grow up where, you know, like maybe your family made Kool-Aid in a way that was entirely unhealthy? You know where they would dump like a half a pound of sugar in the Kool-Aid, and it's like super sweet. So you just like love Kool-Aid because you're like a little, you know, like sugar crackhead. And then somebody would give you Kool-Aid that had a regular level of sweetness where it was supposed to be. Maybe they only put a little sugar in it, or you went to a white person's house where they don't put any sugar in it. And you were like, oh my God, this is disgusting, right? This doesn't taste good at all, right? Well, you know, that I would think about investing kind of like that, right? You know, you can have two people drink the same glass of Kool-Aid with light sugar. One person says, ooh, this is too sweet. And the other person's like, what are you talking about? You need to put some more sugar in this thing. You know, right? And it's because they've obtained different tastes, right? The one person who wants more sugar has a higher sugar tolerance and a higher sugar addiction than the person who says, ooh, this is too sweet, right? And so, and I remember noticing that. I remember noticing that when I was a kid. I'd be like, what are you talking about? How can you drink this and say it's too sweet? This ain't sweet enough. What are you talking about? And I didn't realize it was because, you know, I had aunties that would put like a bucket of sugar in the Kool-Aid. Like what the hell y'all doing, man? So anyway, with investing, the people that got introduced to investing in this era are going to be like I was when it came to the Kool-Aid. Like, they're the ones who want the Kool-Aid to be extra sweet. They're the ones who have grown accustomed. And I'm not making fun of you if you're in this category. It's not really your fault. Maybe you didn't know. But they're the ones who are going to be like, wait, this is boring. What do you mean I got to wait 3 years to make, you know, a 20% ROI on my investment? What are you talking about? I only made 5% this year. So what's going to happen, unfortunately, is they're going to do what I used to do, right, with the Kool-Aid. If I thought the Kool-Aid wasn't sweet enough, what do? You go and you grab some sugar and you start dumping sugar in it so it tastes like the Kool-Aid that you're used to. So I personally think that you'll start seeing a lot of investors that claim to be investors, but if you look at their portfolio, you're not really going to see a healthy, balanced economic diet, right? You're not going to see, diversification. You're not going to see buy and hold strategies. You're not going to see stable, sturdy, long-term wealth building possibilities that will generate massive wealth for their children. Instead, you're going to see, well, hey man, I put 70% of my money into AMC, and I put the other 30% in Shiba Inu, right? If you're investing like that, I'm not making fun of you. Please don't think I'm making, sometimes I sound like a prick. Sometimes I talk and I'm firm and I'm clear. And I hope that at 50 years old, I can be forgiven for sounding like a prick. I heard Dick Gregory got kind of mean when he got older. So maybe just chalk it up to the fact that maybe I'm just a stupid old man. My wife makes fun of me. She says, "You boys, you sound like an old man. You're shaking your fist at the air. Stop shaking your fist at the air." And I'm like, but this shit is so stupid. It makes me mad. And so please just chalk it up to me being an old man shaking his fist at the air. And I hope I have a right to do that. I hope I put enough skin in the game to have the right to yell a little bit. But I will tell you that, you know, that's not that when you're investing like that, you're not really an investor at that point. You're not behaving like an investor. What you're doing, if you got a portfolio where you're telling me that you've got more than half of your assets in stuff like Dogecoin, AMC, and Shiba Inu, that literally, to me, that's just, you know, that's like you telling me you went to Vegas and you took the rent money and went to go try to see if you can hit the numbers. Like literally, that's what that sounds like to me, because there's nothing stable or healthy about that kind of economic layout. Now, what you could do, though, again, to, you know, because it's okay to have fun. Like, I'm gonna tell you the truth. Like I told you guys before, I actually really love poker. I'm a good poker player. And I told y'all how I went to South Dakota and I played those white boys and kicked them in the ass and took all their money. Like I took all their money, because poker is a fun game for me because it's not just luck. It's also skill. So like two players that sit down at a poker table, if one of them's really skilled, the skilled person will eventually get all the money. So I sat down at the table, I took all their money. Like I started with $200. I had $600 within an hour, right? And these guys are mad. Like they were just pissed at me, right? So gambling is okay, right? If it's okay for you, it's okay. But what you must also understand is that gambling is an endorphin releasing exercise that some of us can come to depend on, because it's like taking a drug. You know, it's like that feel good pill. You know, like you get bored, you it's the pandemic, you can't go out and party, so you're sad. So you get online, you start gambling. Because gambling is your medication. That's your morphine. That's your, you know, that's your don't get high on your own supply. That's your you know, the gambling app becomes your dope man. You know, and a lot of people don't even see this because we're not really talking. Everybody's talking about pandemics and catching viruses and all that, but nobody's talking about the other viruses that are spreading rampant through our society. Nobody's talking about the mental illness, the mental health issues that are spreading throughout our society. Nobody's talking about the depression. Ain't nobody talking about the addictions. Ain't nobody talking about the fact that we had a 30%. Did y'all notice? How many of y'all knew this? Give me a yes or no if you knew this. Did y'all know that the number of suicides went up last year by like 30%? Did y'all know that? That you had 30% more suicides than before. And nobody knows it because COVID kind of has taken like everybody's attention. That's literally become the only thing, the only threat out here that can kill you, the only thing that can take you out. And I just kind of think that that's a little disingenuous, because there's a lot of things that are taking young people out. And the interesting thing too, is if you really look at, I mean, just being, you know, just 100% honest, COVID was never a significant threat for young people, right? It was just a matter of a young person catching it and going and giving it to their grandma. So it was really more of a threat for older people or people that had heavy pre-existing conditions, right? You had some, sure, you had some exceptions, right? But for the most part, it was if you take out the old people and you take out anybody who's ever eaten, you know, McDonald's or Popeye's chicken or was overweight, well, you know, then you probably don't even have enough of a death rate to even make a blip on a radar screen, right? I think you have more kids that drowned in the swimming pool than you had that died from the virus, right? So ultimately, what I would say to you guys is that, you know, you have to kind of look, you know, be really, have some great, gain some critical thinking skill. You know, like, I kind of think that if you're a critical thinker, you can look around and see all the problems that we have instead of only focusing on whatever problem the media tells you to focus on. And so one of the things I noticed, since I don't really watch media anymore, my wife and I, you know, like, we listen to stuff like C-SPAN, or sometimes we do NPR or whatever, but, and we do a lot of Black media, and that's it. Like, we don't really do a lot of stuff that's like, you know, like CNN and, you know, and Fox News or MSNBC. Like, we don't believe in any of that crap. We get our news and our information directly. We look it up online. We get statistics. Like, I'll do probabilities. And that's how, you know, that's how I came to my conclusions about the pandemic, was I said, wait a minute, you mean 99.8% of us are going to survive? That doesn't really scare me. You know, I'm a Black man. Like, you know, if I go through the hood, I imagine maybe, you know, if you spend enough time in the hood, you got like one half of 1% chance of being killed this year. Right? Like, seriously, like, there's a lot of things out here that can take you out. And I just kind of felt like we were overreacting a little bit because we didn't understand how to solve one problem within the context of a larger picture. We became one-track minded. And one of the outpourings of this, one of the consequences of the pandemic, is that you had a lot of addictions, and gambling is one of them. In fact, give me a yes or no. If you or someone you know is like on their Robinhood app all the time, like constantly watching it all day long, constantly looking for that money, constantly like trying to see if their little Shiba Inu or their AMC or their Dogecoin went up today, or their GameStop went up today, or super excited, like super frenzied, like a high, like a crackhead the next day because they made money. Like, money, people don't know this. Money has a huge impact on your mind. Money is a drug. Professor Andrew Lowe at MIT literally explained how money hits the, I want to say it's the hypothalamus. I can't remember if it's that part of the brain, but basically it hits the same part of your brain as cocaine. So like, when you make money, you literally get the high that somebody gets from smoking crack. Like, you literally get the high, like, that somebody gets, like, when they literally are like, you know, taking a hit, a coke, right? So that's why you see people acting so crazy and excited, because you get the same high from maybe sex. So that's why maybe, I'm sure, then the pandemic, you probably had a few more sex addicts, right? Because basically what happens, what I've concluded is, and my wife is more of an expert on addiction. She actually teaches classes on addictions. And my guess would be that Black people are more susceptible to these addictions because we got a lot of shit to deal with. You know, we have a lot of stress. You got, you know, crazy relatives, you know, you got financial problems, you got, you know, anxieties from when you were a kid, dopamine and endorphins and all that, right? You got all these things that you're dealing with, all this trauma that you're dealing with, all this anxiety that you're dealing with, all this depression. Nobody has more depression and anxiety in America than the Black woman. And I think the Black man, I'm sure, is right there with her, right? Because there's so many things to be anxious about and afraid about, and this anxiety and depression comes from the trauma. And most of you in here, probably, I bet you that the reason that you listen to people like me is because you are similar to me, because you too have been traumatized by what it feels like to be Black in this country. Like, some of y'all may not be in America, but you know what I'm talking about. Like, all of us have trauma, which can breed the anxiety and the depression, which breeds the coping mechanisms like sex, drugs, gambling, alcohol. Right. You know, that's why you maybe have so many brothers that literally live in the liquor bottle, you know, literally smoke weed every single day of the week, you know, twice on Sundays, because they are, you know, constantly coping, you know, they're constantly dealing with the stress of like, oh man, you know, somebody shot my homie yesterday, or the police are coming to get me and I'm gonna lose my job. And, you know, it's just a lot of stuff to deal with. And that's kind of what ends up happening, right? So gambling to me, when I see all the gambling culture that's happening on social media as a result of what's been going on, you know, Robinhood gamifying, stock market investing, all that, I see that as nothing more than an extension of the fact that we're already engaged in a lot of potentially unhealthy coping mechanisms to deal with all the stressors that may exist in our lives, right? So I think the reason I'm having this conversation is because I kind of want you to just try to be conscious of it. Like, I am not the dude who's here to preach to you or to tell you that there's something wrong with what you're doing. I'm really just the guy who's kind of saying, pay attention, stay woke, look around, be observant, you know, notice these things. Don't just go along with the with what everybody else is doing. Don't think that it's okay because everybody else thinks it's okay. Like, no, it ain't okay just because everybody else thinks it's okay. There's a lot of when I became conscious of how, you know, consistent investing and even things like day trading could be linked to gambling, is I remember this was a long time ago, because you guys know I'm not 25, I'm 50, I'm not a kid. When I was in college, I had a white guy that sat next to me in class, and he was in my finance class, and he was very smart because he had actually been a trader on Wall Street. He'd actually made a lot of money as a trader. And I said, what did you do? And he said, I was a day trader. Now, back then, being a day trader meant you had to get specialized computer systems in your house. It wasn't like the internet where you could just do everything on an app and all that stuff, right? Because he didn't have no apps. And he said that, I said, why did you stop day trading? He said, well, because he was in the 1987 crash. This is how long ago it goes, because he was older than me. And he said that he said, I made $500,000 by lunchtime, and by the end of the day, it was all gone. And he said that what he realized at that, in that experience, was that he had a gambling addiction. So he had to go to Gamblers Anonymous to deal with the fact that day trading was his gambling fix. And he thought that, you know, he thought that it was just investing. He's like, I didn't think I was a gambler because I was investing. He said, no, investing is gambling if you approach it in a certain way. And so, you know, I really just kind of want brothers and women as well, like, to kind of be thoughtful about that, because I remember when I was a kid, you know, my father would talk to me about life and the things I want to watch out for, so I didn't fall in the same traps that a lot of Black men fall into. And what I concluded from listening to my dad, God bless him, he wasn't my biological father, but this man stepped up like a stormtrooper and took good care of me. And I love him for that forever. You know, I mean, that's a real man to me, just a great Black man. He would teach me real life lessons about the things that other Black men were going down on. Like, he had a lot of friends hooked on heroin. He had a lot of friends that were alcoholics. He had a lot of friends that had other kinds of addictions. And one thing he said that was really interesting to me was he said, the worst addiction you can have is gambling. And I was like, worst? And he said, yeah. He said, it's worse. He says, worse than being a junkie. It's worse than being an alcoholic. You know, now, is that true? I don't know. But I do know that I've seen a lot of people get themselves in such a hole from a gambling addiction that they can't never get out. Like, they, you know, I've seen people who had it all, who loved gambling and lost everything and never, ever recovered from that, or got into a situation with a bookie, you know, where somebody's trying to come kill them over gambling debts. There was a couple NBA players actually that have died that way, that were killed, you know, because they had the gambling debts were so big and somebody came and killed them or whatever. You know, and Antoine Walker, for example, I remember Antoine Walker was in the NBA and I think he made $110 million and went broke. And people were like, how did he go broke? Well, a big chunk of it was because he would sit there and gamble with Michael Jordan. And Michael Jordan also was a gambling addict. And I guess maybe MJ, you know, didn't go beyond his limit because he had such a high limit. He made so much money. You know, but I'd be really curious to know how that played out for Jordan, you know, right? Because you remember Jordan's father died under very suspicious circumstances. And they started, you know, the media kind of speculated on the gambling debts and whether or not that was somehow linked to what happened to his dad. Now, I'm not going to go that far now, you know, at all. But I do know, I still don't believe that if that was the whole story, that his father just went to sleep on the highway and somebody came and killed him. I think that, you know, with his life being so complicated, it's not inconceivable that there could have been something else going on. But the point at the end of the day is, you know, I just encourage everybody, especially young people, like, really think about that, man. You know, like, because, you know, you get caught up in some gambling stuff, man, that can ruin you financially forever, and you're stuck for life. And then you know, you got to spend 20, 30 years trying to get out of a hole, and you don't want that feeling, man. It's very depressing. Another area, if you want, like, other things I've seen people do financially that have, like, ruined their lives, stuff like becoming a baby mom or a baby daddy. Ooh, that'll kill you financially. We talked about that enough, but, like, the brokest people I know are single mothers. I swear, single mothers with kids with broke ass men who don't even pay their child support, and men who have lots of kids with multiple women. Like, so again, that's another area where maybe your addiction to sex causes you to just want to go fuck these, like, nasty ass, random ass people. And you're not valuing, you know, your future or valuing your body, you know, by literally saying, I think even for the men, like, I encourage you men to, like, think outside the box on this, right? Like, if you really cherish who you are and what you're trying to accomplish in life, a woman should have to earn the right to be in the bed with you. You know, like, I mean, I you remember thinking that way. And I know people thought it was weird. You know, they were like, oh, she looks good. You should lay down with her. I'm like, why would I want to lay down with this lady who could, first of all, give me a disease that I can't give back? She might come in with some crazy baby mama drama that messes up the rest of my life. She might, you know, be a person who accuses me of rape. She could be a person that just undermines and disrupts everything I'm trying to accomplish. And I really felt that, you know, just one measure of valuing yourself makes me think about, like, you know, when you think about important people, like, a lot of Black folks, I don't think we see ourselves as important. We don't see our lives as important. We have, you know, kind of like a self-esteem issue going on there. And I would look at people that were seen as important in America. Like, I would think about, like, the president of the United States, whether you're talking about Barack Obama or even Donald Trump. And think about the president, right? They spend a lot of money, billions every year, just protecting the president, just making sure the president, you know, isn't in danger. They would keep, you know, dangerous people away from the president. If there's an attack, they're going to go get the president and take him to a special bunker and make sure he's protected. He gets 24-hour protection, even after he's not president anymore. And I remember thinking, my future really matters to me. Like, what I want to be in this world is really important to me. So I'm going to protect my future and protect my life as if I was the president of the United States. I am as important as Barack Obama or, you know, anybody else out here. And that was a decision I remember making on my own. Nobody gave a shit who I was or what I was doing, to be honest with you. Like, nobody give a damn about Boyce Watkins, right? But I did, right? And that rule, just kind of thinking that way, what that did was it changed everything, right? For me to be transactional with you on any level, you got to meet a certain standard. You know, like, I'm not going to hang out with you just because I need a friend. I ain't never been that lonely. Well, I'm going to hang out with some people just because they're willing to hang out with me. No, you got to earn the right to hang out with me. If you wanted to lay down in the bed with me, this is back before I had my wife. If you wanted to lay down in the bed with me, I don't care how pretty you are and how big your booty is. Like, you got to earn the right to sleep with the president. If you haven't earned the right to sleep with me, then no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to bring some ragamuffin type woman into my space who might disrupt and ruin everything I have going on. I'm not doing that. I'm protecting all of this, right? And I noticed, like, I don't think a lot of us think that way, right? We let a lot of toxins into our lives, you know? And then you think about it, it's a lot like COVID, actually. You know, COVID is like, COVID doesn't kill most people, right? It doesn't, 99.8% of all people who catch COVID are going to be just fine. COVID doesn't really kill you, from what I'm gathering. COVID just kind of takes advantage of pre-existing vulnerabilities, right? Like, COVID isn't like the criminal who's going to bust the gate down at your house. He's the criminal that's going to walk in if you leave the door unlocked. You know, so if you leave the door unlocked, then he's like, well, shit, I mean, it ain't like it's hard to rob you because I caught you slipping. I caught you leaving the door open. So that's why I'm coming in and I'm going to take everything, you know. And the thing about that is that it's like, you know, like for a lot of us, we miss opportunities, or we don't succeed, or we fail miserably because we simply make ourselves vulnerable. We leave the door unlocked. You know, you let people into your life and, you know, you leave the door unlocked and a predator is in your space because you didn't vet the people that came into your life. You know, you leave the door unlocked and you're not, you know, you're not protecting yourself, whether you're talking about education or saving your money or investing or making good decisions in life or whatever. And then when something bad happens, like a pandemic or something, you're totally unready for it. You're not prepared at all. You know, like talk, you know, it's very, one way to get Black people excited is to react to something. Like I watch Black people a lot. I pay attention to them, right? Because that's all I pretty much talk to. And so I study our people pretty closely. So we tend to get real amped up when we're reacting to something. Like when something terrible happens to a Black person, we're like, oh, Lord Jesus, oh my God, I can't believe that happened. What the hell? What the fuck? Blah, 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 right? But if you ever want to bore a lot of Black people, like if you ever want to bore the Black community, talk about like something that's preventative. You know, like go and say something like, hey, you know, okay, we got our butts kicked in this pandemic, but here's how we can prepare for the next one. A lot of people ain't going to listen to that conversation. Or, you know, or if you say, hey, here's how you can make sure that your kids don't struggle economically the way you did. You know, a lot of people just, that's not an interesting discussion. It's like, why would I think about something that hasn't happened yet? Right. And what people don't understand is like that the reason that that's not common, the reason a lot of people have an issue with that, I think, is because that's a power move. Like that's not a move that's a move that an empowered person makes. That's a move that a power broker makes. A power broker is typically, in most cases, just a person or entity that was prepared. They got ready. Like when you say, talk about like football, power football, you know, is typically a game that's won by the team that's the most prepared. Their linemen are the biggest and the strongest. Their game plan is the tightest. Their wide receivers are the fastest. Their quarterbacks have been practicing the hardest, right? They've been in the weight room the longest, right? So they're able to play power football because they are more prepared than the other team, right? And so that those power moves are not as appealing as like the victim moves, right? Because we've been trained to be in that victim status. So you're kind of spending your life waiting for something else to go wrong. You're waiting for the next tragedy because that all reminds you that of your victim status, right? So you end up just sort of reacting to things, right? So pay attention now. Notice, just observe it. I'm not telling you to agree with me. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe some of the shit I'm saying is bullshit. I don't know. But I'm gonna give you the truth based on what I see. Pay attention. Watch how strong people react online when you have a conversation or you talk about some terrible situation where Black people were victimized. When you see those conversations, you'll see Black folks getting real riled up. We love to get riled up because we see ourselves as losers. We see ourselves as victims. We see ourselves as the people who are always going to be in last place. So when that happens, it just re-triggers us and we start going crazy and chaotic. Lord Jesus, I can, you know, it happened to us again. Look at what happened to us again. But to me, the conversations that don't get as much attention, the ones that I encourage you to train yourself to listen to, are the conversations that teach you preventative maintenance. Right. Most of the problems that most of my friends have and that I've had are problems that could have been prevented. Literally, like some of us, you know, some of y'all have been broke at some point. Right. You're broke now or you used to be broke. Right. That problem is easily preventable. You do know that. Right. Like you do know that broke acidness is an easily preventable disease. Right. Like if you're infected with broke acidness, you know that disease was preventable. There is a vaccine against broke acidness. And all that is investing. Like if somebody invested for you, you know, let's say somebody just put a little bit of money aside for you in the stock market back in the 70s or the 80s, and the stock market was around then. You know, George Jefferson used to talk about talking to his stockbroker on the Jeffersons, right? But the thing was, we would watch George Jefferson talk about his stockbroker, but we didn't actually see ourselves as people who would actually be doing what we saw George and Wheezy doing, right? So basically, if somebody had just started investing small amounts of money for you back, you know, like before you were born or when you were a little kid, you would be very wealthy right now. Like you would have every financial problem you have literally could have been solved in the past. The reason that your financial problems are hard to solve is because you waited too late. It's like if you go to the doctor and your cancer has reached stage 4, well, there's not a lot they can do for you, you know. But if you start, you know, like with pre-diagnosis, and you do things like you avoid certain foods, and you exercise, and you eat right, and you know, you do all the things that you need to do, then you can be a little bit more healthier. The doctors can do more for you, right? You get what I'm saying? You know, and I hope I don't sound like I'm being overly preachy, and maybe I am preaching a little bit. And I'm okay with preaching some if you think that what I'm sharing with you can help you. Because, you know, I know some things, right? I've seen some things, I understand some things, I understand economics at a very high level. And so a lot of the problems that people think are really unsolvable are actually quite simple to me. They're not complex. You know, it's like, yeah, well, you know, you don't have any money because you never invested anything, and or you put your energy into the wrong part of the economy. Yeah, you work hard, but you worked hard is the reason. Like for example, I saw where there was a statement where where somebody said that inflation is a tool used by the rich to steal wealth from the poor, and I totally agree with that. Right? Like I said, yeah, that's actually true. Like, you know, inflation does benefit rich people more than everyone else, but it's not like inflation itself benefits rich people. What you're actually seeing is that inflation actually benefits investors. That's it. It's not that it benefits rich people. It just benefits investors. There are lots of investors who are not rich, right? Being an investor will make you rich, but and being rich means you are probably an investor. But, you know, it's not as if you have to be rich in order to be an investor. Do you follow what I'm saying? I hope that makes sense. And so effectively, you know, this whole idea, right? Like, so when you see a quote like that, like inflation is a tool used by the rich to make themselves rich at the expense of the poor, you have to make that statement without making the unconditional assumption that you have no choice of which category you're going to be in, right? So I say, you know, everybody on the left side of the room keeps getting shot in the leg, and everybody on the right side of the room gets a turkey sandwich. I can try to move to the right side of the room. Right? Like, who told you that you can't move to the other side of the room? You know, and maybe it's hard. Maybe there's not, you know, I know that the public school system and all that doesn't provide a lot of training on this. And that's where I think people like myself can help with that, right? Because there's nothing you ever learned at a white man's university that I can't teach you or talk to you about when it comes to economics. Like, 'cause I taught at those schools, they paid me hundreds of thousands of dollars to do that, right? You know, so these things are things that people in our community know. And I'm not the only one. There's a lot of really smart Black people there. In fact, at the All Black National Convention, a lot of them are going to be there. And all this information is there. But I think also it requires kind of a shift in thinking where you can't keep continuously trusting the system to educate you on how to beat the system, right? The system does not, that's not the system's job. It's not the job of the system or the system's gatekeepers to teach you how to beat the system. The job of the system is to make sure you are an active participant in the system. You know, if I am capitalism, you know, or whatever, and I am America, why, there's no reason for me to ever train you to do something that isn't in line with the interests of America or in line with the interests of capitalism. So a lot of movements, a lot of things that they tell you to do, you think you're being empowered and you think it's grassroots and everything else. A lot of it's really just designed to, like, you know, get more workers or whatever. Even things like, and I was really surprised by this, you know, when I finally, began to understand it. Even things like the women's movement and stuff like that. A lot of that stuff was built on basically trying to get women to come to work. They were like, we need more workers. we'll make more money if we can get people to come to work. So we have to, you know, use our power in the media to shift the culture. So what we want to do is we want to make it uncool for a woman to want to spend time with her kids. And we have to make it so that a woman doesn't even feel like she's a real woman unless she spends more time at the factory or the corporate plantation than she spends with her own kids. And that's a process, right? So you got to the point where, just like, you know, people telling you to go get the jab or telling you to go vote for the Democrats, women started pressuring other women by basically making them feel like, if you ain't working, then you ain't shit. Like, you know, and it took you away from the fundamental truth, in my view, which is that motherhood is like it's like probably the most fucking important job ever invented in the history of all mankind. How in the world can you act like motherhood is like for suckers? Like, that's crazy, right? But that's what we have, like, motherhood is for suckers, like that kind of mindset, you know, and where, you know, where the most important job in the world is not being done as effectively as it used to. Used to be, because everybody wants to go to work at the corporate plantation. And I just reject that. I'm not saying that you can't do what you want to do. I'm just saying that a lot of people get their, you know, they get their trends, and they get their, you know, they figure out what's cool based on what everybody else is doing. And if you do that, I think you're going to probably get what everybody else is getting, which is, you know, a constant feeling of a powerlessness, a constant feeling of victimization, a constant feeling that by being Black, you're always in last place, that you can never win. And you can't win because the game is rigged, but you keep signing up for the rigged game. You know, and I would say, if I was to define, you know, like I don't know. I mean, I hear people on the, I got enough haters on the internet to, I guess, say that I must be a successful person, because I get people that look up my net worth on, you know, on online, and, you know, talk crazy or whatever. So I will say this, that if I had to define something that made a difference in my life that allowed me to be successful, it was that I just basically said, if I feel like the game is rigged, I'm not playing the game. Like, I don't even, and I may not even know how the game is rigged or why, or what you're doing or whatever. I'm not going to spend time even trying to figure that out. I'm just not going to play, right? Because if I don't participate, if I don't play the game at all, then whatever little scheme you have, whatever trick you're using to pull a rope-a-dope on me, you won't even have the opportunity to do it, because I won't even be in the room. So we don't even have to even get to the point where I'm trying to figure out how you're going to outsmart me, because I'm not even going to be in your system, right? So I will tell you this, you know, this is especially for like young people that are younger than me, that maybe you got kids or whatever. If I were a new parent right now and I had kids right now, I'm not going to have any more kids. You know, I wish I could. I love children, you know, and that's a regret. That was a trade-off I made, actually. You know, when I married a woman, where we were kind of done with kids. But honestly, I kind of wished I could have had more kids. But then again, I've gotten a chance to help you raise your kids. So that makes me, actually, that fulfills me in a lot of different ways. But, you know, but here's the, if I had kids, here's one thing I would do. I would totally homeschool them. And I would totally not on any level send them to a public school at all. Because public schools are not educational facilities, they are indoctrination factories. They're just places that indoctrinate you into a certain line of thinking, and it may not be beneficial to Black people. The second thing I would do is I would actually run my economics through the family. I would look at my family like it's a corporation, which means that I would have, you know, delegation and separation of responsibilities and high level training, so that everybody in the household has, you know, has a chore, a task. I would come together with other families to form economic systems. Like, you can actually form an economy in a small group of people, right? So I would probably, like, you know, get with my neighbors and my friends that I trust, and I would say, okay, you know, let's figure out how we're going to make some money. Let's find out where the needs are. Let's figure out, you know, let's take our economic training and put it to work. And none of us is going to go work for white people because we've been abused by by others. I mean, we don't hate white people, but, you know, working for white people has never worked for Black people. Working for white people, integration was not a win for Black people. Integration was a win for white people, because they got a lot of free workers. They got us to kind of give away everything that was valuable in order to be a part of whatever they had going on. And we lost because of that. Like, our wealth just got zapped and drained. Our sense of free will, economically speaking, was totally annihilated. We were put in a position where we're incredibly vulnerable. And on top of that, they've taken over our children's minds. Like, they pretty much decide what your kids are going to think is important. And so they turned a lot of our own people against us, right? They take a lot of our young people. And, you know, a lot of times when I'm, you know, doing the things that, like, look at it right now, like, look at, you know, like with Dave Chappelle kind of speaking his truth, you know, a lot of his enemies right now are Black people, you know, Black people who probably went to, you know, Stanford or something, and they feel like they're smarter because they went to a big white university that taught them a bunch of terms like toxic masculinity and transphobia and whatever, that, you know, make them feel smart. And they really feel like they have some sort of implicit authority. And it's largely driven by the fact that they have this artificially contrived, questionable validation coming from the very same people who've oppressed us for hundreds of years. I say, you know, that it's okay to kind of just reject all of that. Right. Like, I think it's okay to kind of be radical and say, yeah, I don't believe in any of that bullshit because the shit that it don't work, right? It doesn't empower Black folks on any level. And I think just kind of knowing that and taking that approach is kind of a way for us to sort of, you know, be able to build something better, you know, build something, you know, that works, that really works in our interest. And that's where things like, you know, like a B1 philosophy are so important, because all B1 kind of really says is just, you know, do things that are in your own interest, period. You know, like don't just do things because somebody told you or because it's popular or because that'll get you a job or whatever. Like do things where you say, look, you know, I'm taking care of mine. You take care of yours. I don't hate you. I'm not mad at you. I'm not, you know, I expect reparations, but I'm not really expecting it. Like I expect it, but I know you're probably not going to pay it. So I'm not going to hate you, but I'm not going to give you anything, right? I'm not going to, whatever you've gotten it. You're not going to get anything else from me. And because I'm going to spend my time working on myself, right? I'm no longer going to be like the slave who spent more time breastfeeding the white woman's kids than I spend with my own. My children are now the top priority. And it was my fault, in fact, in the beginning, that I ever let your children be my top priority, because your children shouldn't have been my top priority. My children should have been my top priority. Your people should never have been my top priority. My people should have been my top priority, right? I should have been my top priority. And I think that just sort of starting there allows us to kind of, you know, figure out what needs to be done and how to actually solve those problems. And then also, I think when you talk about what goes on inside the mind of a Black person, I see a lot of ideas in the Black community that did not originate in the Black community. So I think one aspect of consciousness and wokeness and everything else is to really be fully aware and conscious. So like, okay, everybody's saying that this is what Black people are supposed to be doing. Where did that come from? Who made that rule? Like, who came up with that? You know, and I think that that kind of allows us to kind of vet and make sure that any ideas that we embrace or take on as a community are ideas that are beneficial to the community. Because I mean, I'm telling you, man, the people that own the media and the way the media kind of the media, actually, it's not just media. It's like the public school system, universities. Those are three areas I'm thinking about that where the indoctrination takes place. It's pretty fascinating how they deliberately will just sit around and they'll say, okay, we need to get more Black people on board with this idea. And then they'll say, okay, here's the strategy to do that, right? And I think that they're able to do that because a lot of Black folks don't really know who they are. I think they're able to do that because a lot of Black folks are seeking acceptance and validation. If you listen to Black people talk about, you know, what another successful, so-called successful Black person did, they'll usually talk about something like a good job that he got, right? He got a good job at such and such, right? Or, you know, how much money he makes from that good job, or look at the neighborhood he's living in, or, you know, he was on TV, right? And so what that to me says is that it becomes white supremacy because, you know, I ask myself, I say, well, who put him on TV? Oh, white people did. Who gave him that job? Oh, white people did. Who gave him that high salary? Oh, white people did, right? Who gave him that award? Oh, white people did. So what you're basically doing is you're giving other people the keys to your success and validation. That's what you're doing. You're letting other people have the right to tell you what a successful Black person looks like. And so that's why in many cases, your so-called most successful Black people become the greatest enemies of the Black community that there ever were, because these people are plants. These people are Trojan horses. You know, they literally are, you know, it's it's literally like a virus that's being injected into your spiritual and political and social, socioeconomic body. And the viruses are killing you, you know? And so my belief is that to fight the virus, I'm okay with, you know, various forms of social distancing. And again, starting with the economic systems and the educational systems, because remember, systematic racism means that you're being racially discriminated against by a system. So you fight systems by, you know, getting out of those systems. You don't try. I mean, you could try to change it, but it's really hard to change a system when you're a subordinate member of that system. Like if I go into another man's house and I don't like the way his household is being run, the only thing I could really do is leave the house. I can't like change the rules in another man's house. So the best thing for me to do is build my own house. But if I don't have the money to build a, to get a house, or I can't, don't have the skill to build a house, then I'm stuck living with him, right? So effectively, they have you inside another man's house and never gave you the skills or the ability to seek out and purchase or build your own house. So when you're talking about what it means to educate truly free Black people, people that are free from all this oppression and microaggression at work and mistreatment or whatever, you got to teach kids how to build their own house, right? So if I'm raising Black kids, I make it absolutely essential that my children learn how to start a business by the age of 12, just so they know how to make some extra spare change they need to. A lot of folks run into financial problems that can literally be solved with an extra $2,000 a month. I kid you not. Like literally like life or death financial issues, where if they just had if they could just figure out a way to cop $2,000, they would be good. You know, they'd be able to get by for another month. And a lot of our people can't even do that. Can't do that without getting a paycheck. Right. That's an incredibly dangerous position to be in. What else would I do with that kid? I would make sure that child, I wouldn't buy a single goddamn toy for my child until my child owned at least, you know, a few thousand dollars worth of stock. No, we're not buying. Or maybe I buy. I wouldn't want to be like totally unfun. I think childhood should be fun. So I think buying toys are cool. But every time I bought you a toy, maybe I buy you stock of the company that made the toy, right? And then I will be talking to you about why owning the stock is just as valuable, if not more valuable, than owning the toy. Like, everything will be a lesson. Everything will be an ownership opportunity. Ownership would just become like literally the culture, because I'm telling you, ownership is the key to power and control. Ownership is the key to freedom. So a person that doesn't own anything should never expect to be free. How are you going to be free when you can't control your environment? Like, you control nothing. You have no power. You have no say over your environment. So what in the world makes you think you're free? What, because you think you've achieved equality? Well, you can't be equal. Like, if I own you, or if I own the environment and you don't, and you work for me, then, you know, no, you're not the powerful person in our conversation. You're not equal to me. You can't be equal to me if I own you. What are you talking about? That's stupid. That makes no sense. So ultimately, you know, concepts like equality are stupid. They're just stupid. It's just a bunch of bullshit that somebody made up to make us feel better so that we wouldn't be angry former slaves, you know? I don't care about equality. that's honestly like a joke. I'm thinking about preparation. I'm assuming everything is war. I'm assuming that every man out here that I meet is thinking about taking care of his family, not mine. And I'm also assuming, again, based on where I come from, that man is never going to respect me if I cannot take care of and defend and support that which is mine. And I know that those are hyper-masculine, hyper-masculine concepts. And not everybody is going to think that way. I know Alicia, when I talk like that, Alicia thinks everything is kumbaya and everybody wants to be friends and, you know, all that. And that's fine, because I don't feel as a woman, her job is to always think that way. In fact, the reason she can take that Mary Poppins approach to life is because she's got a lion that is protecting her. Now, if she had to be the lioness and always protect herself, I think she would probably see things a little bit different. You know, so I personally encourage you, like, just get over the fairy tale, man. Like, life is not, you know, life ain't fair. Life will never be fair, you know? So don't catch yourself crying because life ain't fair, because it's never going to be fair. You know, and the best you can do, I think, is make sure that if it's going to be unfair, that the unfairness works in your favor. Right. So I hope that makes sense. I sat here and I just did a whole stream of consciousness. I literally was talking about a whole bunch of stuff, but y'all know how I do. So anyway, boyswalkers.com is actually where my website is. You can go there and get a free e-copy of my book. It's called It Takes a Village to Raise the Bar. Also, the All Black National Convention is at the end of this month, October 29th through November 3rd. We are meeting in Orlando, Florida. So feel free to join us at the convention. There's a little flyer. That's Queen of Four. Queen of Four is like super smart. And she is actually a health expert who is going to be at the convention. I was super excited to have Queen of Four, because here's why I invited Queen of Four, why I went out of my way. I reached out to Jay Morris and I said, man, you got to connect me with Queen of Four, because she's what our people need right now. And the reason I had Jay introduce me to Queen of Fua is because I said, everybody's talking about, you know, getting whether you're going to get the jab or not get the jab. We're talking about jabs and pills and all this other stuff and mandates. And I said, ain't nobody talking about health. Like, does anybody else notice that? Like, there's literally no conversation about how you can just generally be healthier and be prepared, you know, for the next virus that comes up. Because now that they know that pandemics are so profitable, the next pandemic is coming. Just know, I think they just realized, hey, wait a minute, we need to come up with something a little bit stronger next time so we can get everybody on board. So the next pandemic is coming. And you know, because there's too much money being made from, like, pills and jabs and everything else, right? So people like Queen of Fua, to me, are a matter of Black national security because she can help you prepare so that you're not just stuck believing that, you know, that Big Pharma giving you a jab is your only line of defense. Like, if your only line of defense, like, if the only thing you think that can protect you from the horrors in the night is Big Pharma, I kind of feel sorry for you, because Big Pharma, I did a video about it, breaking down how much money they make and how they operate and what they do. It's insane. Like, literally, Big Pharma is, they're like, you know what, Big Pharma, I call them Big Worm. Anybody remember Big Worm from Friday? Like, you know, like Big Worm, the dope dealer who came back with the perm, who was trying to kill Smokey because he didn't sell all the weed or something like that, or he smoked it up or whatever. Well, like Big Pharma is like Big Worm. Like, they want their money. They're not really in this business because they care about you. Drugs like Xanax, I think Xanax, for example, I guess a lot of white women take Xanax. Their markup on Xanax is like 560,000%. Like, they literally will take a pill that costs like 50 cents and sell the damn pill for like $130. It's insane. So Big Pharma is not your friend. Like, that's my point. That is not your friend. And so rather than leaning on Big Pharma, aka Big Worm, I wanted to get Queen of Fua, because Queen of Fua is a wonderful woman. She is so smart. You know, she understands the human body like nobody's business. She's living proof of that. Did anybody ever see that picture? I'm gonna find the picture. I'm gonna try to put it on the screen. Did anybody ever see that picture where they show the images of all the health ministers, like, around the world, like all these white health ministers that were like morbidly obese and ugly and pale? And anybody remember that? Give me a yes or no if you can still hear me. I'm actually pulling up the image now. It was really a scary image, right? So why do I bring that up? Well, because, you know, if your own health is all fucked up, like, you know, like, if you're looking like you might drop dead at any moment, I don't necessarily feel comfortable with you giving me advice on how to be healthy. I just don't. Like, I'm gonna pull this lady up on the screen so y'all can see her. This tripped me out. And I'm not, you know, I know people get mad at me because they think I'm being, they invent words for people that tell the truth. Like, they would call this fat phobic, but I would say, fuck you. Because look at this lady. This lady is the health minister of, like, I forgot if it's Denmark or Norway or something. I don't want a lady like that giving me any advice on how to be healthy. I just don't. Like, she needs somebody. Somebody to call the doctor for that lady. Get an ambulance. Like, not an ambulance. Get an ambulance. She needs an ambulance to haul her ass to the hospital, and she needs to be put in a fat farm immediately. I'm not making fun of, well, maybe I am. Okay. Yeah, I am. But seriously, you asked for it. You're up here telling me that you're going to give me advice on how to be healthier. You're going to tell me what critical health decisions I need to make for me and my family, what substances I need to put in my body, and you're mandating that. But your shit is completely out of whack. Like, protect her. She needs triple jabs and needs to be put in quarantine for the rest of her life, because if COVID gets a hold of her, COVID's going to eat today. COVID's going to have a triple kill because this lady is a sitting duck. Right. So don't you dare tell me. Don't you come in here with your big, overly bloated ass. I'm not making fun of overweight people. I promise you. A lot of us are overweight. Don't get me wrong. But I never made the mistake of thinking that the world would not notice. You can't come up in here telling me how to be healthy You know, and that's why I listen to people. I'll listen to like a Queen of Fua, because when you look at Queen of Fua, Queen of Fua is 68 years old with the energy of a 30-year-old. You know, she is a woman who, she is an elder, but has more energy than the young people do. Doesn't that mean anything? Is there no such thing as proof of concept? Like, is there no such thing as somebody just, you know, like giving you something to aspire to, right? And so I see people like Queen of Fool as aspirational. That's my point. I want, when you're talking about the health ministers of the Black community, the Black, and I don't have this picture, but Nathaniel Jordan, the minister of wellness, that's another brother that's going to be there. Nathaniel Jordan is in great shape. Nathaniel Jordan has a track record to support what he's saying in terms of health. Nathaniel Jordan, the minister of wellness, who will also be at the All Black National Convention, is a brother who saw his father. He has an amazing story. He saw his father eat himself into a grave. He saw his father eat himself, to death. And he said, and then he also saw himself doing the same thing, going down the same path. And if I'm not mistaken, I think this brother lost like 150, 200 pounds. So come on, man. Those are the people you'd want to get your health advice from. I'm not trying to tell you what to do about jabs and no jabs. That's up to you, man. That's totally up to you. But the mere fact, the pay attention now. The fix is in on this, in my view, because the mere fact that that they've been talking all day about drugs and jabs and not speaking at all in media about how to be healthy and how to have a healthy immune system, that tells me that Big Pharma is in the background pulling some strings. That just tells me. You can't tell me that that's not the case, because I remember, anybody remember when Michelle Obama first came in and she was doing all that those healthy initiatives, like saying that everybody should like exercise and eat right and all that? Remember when she first came into the White House and that was her whole thing? Her whole thing was health, 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 right? So one day I remember she made a comment about McDonald's French fries. And she said something like, she said, yeah, well, I love McDonald's French fries too. But I don't eat them anymore because I want to be healthy. Right. Well, that was when the food industry stepped in and said, we want to help the first lady with her initiative. Help. Right. Help with air quotes. And so they basically said they went behind closed doors and they put the hammer down and they effectively told, they pushed the White House to the point where they basically were like, look, you can tell people to exercise, but do not tell them to eat healthy. Do not tell them to stop eating Wendy's and Burger King and Popeye's chicken, because that's going to hurt our profitability. And so as a result, Michelle Obama's whole rhetoric changed. She started, instead of talking about eating healthy, all she talked about was like doing jumping jacks in the front yard, right? So eat your Taco Bell and your Burger King and your Popeye's chicken. But after that, just do some jumping jacks and it's going to be okay. And the thing that I've learned about our food in America and in general is that this is not the kind of food where you can just eat like a dog and then work it all off and it's going to go away. Like, this food is literally, a lot of this food is straight up poison. This food is causing cancer. You know, that's another pandemic that people are overlooking. You know, you have the pandemics of addictions, you have the pandemics of depression, you have the other pandemics of suicide, all that. Well, a lot of people are talking about the pandemics of things like cancer because you're just used to it. Like, you're used to, in fact, let me ask you this, let me just prove my point. How many of y'all, give me a guess or no, how many of y'all have a person in your family who has died from either cancer or diabetes or some sort of heart-related ailment, like heart disease or stroke or whatever? Like, give me a guess in the chat. In fact, say the name of the relative if you want to remember them. I'm big on that. I don't know if that's superstition or not, but I like saying people's names because I feel like it keeps them alive. So say the name of a loved one you can think of right now who died from something like cancer, heart disease, stroke, diabetes, or whatever. Say the person's name. All right. So Nathaniel says, my daddy. Renee says, sadly, yes. George, Nathaniel George. George, that's your dad's name? All right. Ashe to George. So say some more names. I'll repeat a couple of names. Let me see. Marie, my mother, says Yves Damon. Renee says my dad. Okay, RIP to your dad. You know, a lot of us, Ellen Brown, okay, from Vincent. All right, so here's the deal. The reason I make this point is because, you know, and for me, it's Felicia, my grandmother Felicia, right? Mike says my aunt. My grandmother Felicia died from cancer, and it made me really think more about cancer. And so like Marshall says, my grandmother, my mother, and my father. So take care of your health, because that stuff is a lot, some of that can be a little bit genetic, right? And what I learned from kind of sort of looking into that is that there's a lot of crap that we eat in the United States that causes us to have these ailments. When I was looking at Big Pharma and studying, I did a video actually on this channel about all the things about Big Pharma you need to know about, that you need to kind of worry about. One of the things that I thought was really peculiar was they talked about how in America, there's like cancer medication and stuff like that. Like, we lead the world in the use of cancer medication, if I'm not mistaken. It's like cancer and something else, where literally it was almost like some of those diseases pretty much almost always only happen to Americans. And the reason you don't know that is because you've never been anywhere else, right? You've never been to places where they don't have the same issues that we have, or you've never been to a place where there aren't very many fat people. A lot of people come to America from other countries and they say, God damn, Americans are so fat. Why are they all so fat? Well, it's because your food is poison. They will put rat poison in your food if it tastes good, you know, and they can get away with it because the FDA is not going to help. They're not going to protect the consumer. This is actually, an example of when I was saying to you guys, I've said it before that, you know, that the reason your government's not effective is because the drug dealers are running the police station, right? You have so much capitalist corruption. This is the downside of capitalism. I'm not anti-capitalist, but in this particular case, I can see this as an example of capitalism gone wild. And effectively, what you have is you have a situation where, because the money's so good, a lot of our government officials are not going to do what's right for the American people. They're doing what's right for the corporation, because the corporation has so much economic power. And then when the corporation doesn't like what a candidate is doing, they just use their economic power to make sure that person doesn't get elected. So they fund their opponents. So a lot of your politicians are really hamstrung by some of these mandates. And now the interesting thing is, this could be easily fixed if you have people in office with the political will to address it. The problem is, though, that the people that are in office are controlled by the corporation. So you really don't have a government anymore. You don't have regulation. Think about capitalism like a power, like it's powerful. It's like a fire, you know, and imagine a fire that's just allowed to burn. Like it's not being controlled. Like, fire itself is not a bad thing. Like, fire, you know, can help you in a lot of ways. But when fire is left unregulated, it just burns everything down. So right now, capitalism is burning down your government. Capitalism is burning down your society. And there's nobody there. There is no fire truck. There is no fireman. You know, so every now and then there'll be people like, I think it was Robert Reich who really is trying. You know, he used to work under Bill Clinton, and he's a little short man, but very smart economist, labor economist. And he'll say some things where I'll listen to him and I'll say, you know, this guy really hasn't figured out. And one of the things he mentioned was, Elon Musk I guess he's the first guy worth $200 billion or something, or the second or something. But anyway, either way, though, one thing he said the average American would have to work like 40,000 years or something to make the amount of money that Elon Musk has, you know. And it's kind of one of those things where you just got this out of control nonsense going on. There are people who understand it very clearly, who can explain it to you. But the reason that the fire is going to burn down the building is because the people who see the fire and have an issue with it and see where this is going don't have the power to address or fix those issues. You know, they're not the ones that the politicians are listening to. They're not the ones that even the public is listening to, because the public tends to listen to people who are getting financial support. Right. So, you know, when they're getting financial support for a politician is marketing. That's it. It's just marketing dollars. Right. Marketing matters. So when a politician is running for office, they get the corporations to back them. The corporations give them, you know, millions of dollars for good marketing so they can paint them as a good candidate, paint them as a good guy. Y'all fall for the shit every time. You say, oh, I like Raphael Warnock. He's a good guy. He's a fighter, blah, blah, blah. Well, Raphael Warnock had $250 million in rich people's money behind him that was designed solely to ensure that he would be able to convince black people and some white people as well that he was a good dude. I'm not saying that he's not. I'm just saying that he ain't your hero. He's not your hero. The heroes are people like Queen of Four, people that really represent the community in an authentic way. And I mentioned these other two brothers right here that are going to be there, Al Duncan and Freddie Taylor. And I love these two guys. These guys are, I think, in their 40s or early 50s. And both of these guys have made millions and millions of dollars. And they're both extremely intelligent. They're also extremely good at educating Black people. And they're extremely collegial, right? They're just good people, right? And so they're, you know, these guys, I bring these guys up because when I'm looking around at the people I admire, like, these are my heroes. Like, these are the people, you know, I've never, maybe it's because of my age or whatever, but I don't look toward TV and entertainment for the people that I admire and that I look up to. I look at the community and I say, who's really getting it done, right? Who's really making things happen? Who's making a difference? So, you know, guys like Al and Freddie, you know, they both have wives. They ain't got a bunch of babies mamas. You know, they are efficient with their money. They make solid investments. They ain't trying to go to a strip club and make it rain. They made their money by running their businesses. Al's an extraordinary speaker who's made millions of dollars as a speaker. Freddie, he has he educates Black children. He has Black History flashcards that have done extremely well. He's made millions of dollars that way. They raise their children in an appropriate way. They believe in the Black community. They believe in Black family. They have a tremendous amount of courage. And these are the guys like this are the men where if I could multiply them, like if I could literally create 10 million, 5 million men like this, we would never have problems again in our community. Every Black woman would have a good man by her side. Every Black child would have a strong, sturdy role model to look up to. Every Black family would have adequate protection, economically, psychologically, spiritually, et cetera. There would not be abandoned kids all splattered all throughout our community, right? You wouldn't see Black men running around blowing each other's brains out and then putting it on a rap album, right? You wouldn't see all this butter biscuit cooning that you're seeing from these politicians who don't have a backbone to save their life. If you had a million men, just a million men like Freddie Taylor and Al Duncan, you would have the greatest community on the planet. So one of the things that I believe we're able to do is, you know, take advantage of something that, quite frankly, I actually learned this from studying in America. One of the things that America did that was really impressive, well, this is shout out, you know, to some of what the white man did. He, you know, everything he did wasn't terrible. And they had the Industrial Revolution. And the Industrial Revolution was kind of this era where they, and I'm sure there were lots of Black people involved as well, because we were kind of always in the backdrop of everything. But the Industrial Revolution was this era where we learned how to kind of mass produce the things that we wanted to see in the world. We learned how to basically take something that's working and just multiply it. Like, you start a factory and, you know, you go in and you make one Ford Model T and then that works. So you then make, you know, another one and another one. Next thing you know, you got 1,000 of these cars coming off the assembly line every single day, et cetera, right? That was kind of the beauty of America. That's one of the things that made America great when it was great, economically anyway, was the ability to just mass produce, right? The ability to kind of take something that was a good idea and do it on a massive scale. That's not something that we as a Black community have really embraced, like is industrialization, systematizing things, et cetera, so you can do things on a massive scale. We tend to have leadership that is kind of like one-off. Like we'll have one really great Black man that everybody looks up to and there won't be a replacement. You don't have a backup plan. Right. So what you're doing is you're breaking one important rule of investing, which is that you diversify your assets. You always have to have a plan B, a plan C, a plan D, a plan E, a plan F, a plan whatever, G. Right. You got to keep going all the way down to the alphabet and then you start all over again. And so basically what I am thinking here, right, in terms of like a strategy that can help us just achieve so much power and so much success long term is we got to identify, you know, the Freddie Taylors and the Al Duncans and the Queen of Fools and just literally study them and multiply them. Like make that the blueprint for Blackness, you know, just kind of you know, like fuck the dumb shit, you know, forget all the crap that you're learning in the public school system, because you know that stuff doesn't work. Like literally, just replicate the people that are really winning, you know, and those are the ones that are gonna get you to the promised land, man. And if you have, like, if you're successful at systematizing the things you believe in, then, you know, then nobody can really defeat you. You've got an army, right? Like no community, no group of people on this earth has ever been able to achieve freedom or any real power without having some kind of an army. So I think the one question I would ask is, you know, where's our army? Like, where's our, you know, where are our soldiers? You know, not just soldiers that carry guns, but soldiers, maybe soldiers that carry books, maybe soldiers that make investments and start businesses, you know, maybe soldiers that, you know, can come together and solve problems for the community, defend the community, right? I don't think we have enough soldiers, you know? So my argument is that we should be very strategic and very consistent in terms of systematizing everything that's good in our community, everything that's winning, every person that's figured out how to make money, every person that's come up with a good educational model. What was it? You had Freedom Home Academy International in Chicago, which does a great job of educating Black children. Like, you know, I've always said, you know, man, if we could get like $50 billion and literally just hand that money to a board of people who literally take that model and spread it all throughout the Black community, all across the world, Black people can't lose. Like we would not lose. Like we would win every time. So that's what I want to see. You know, I want to see us being more strategic with it instead of just being emotional and whatever, like and reactionary. Like, I think that the emotionality is fine. The emotionality can have a place. Like, I think that that's cool. Like, I think that makes you spiritual and it makes you powerful in a certain way. But it becomes very exhausting because you're just sitting around kind of just constantly getting mad at what white people just did to you instead of actually thinking strategically and systematically on how you can make yourself, you know, pretty much impenetrable, you know, to any force, any outside force. And also the other thing, too, you got to know about freedom is that you can't have freedom if you aren't prepared to defend it, right? So typically around the world, what I've noticed is that throughout the history of this globe, people have attacked each other for no reason. Countries, you know, in Europe, this is why Europeans are so savage and crazy sometimes is, you know, in Europe, you just had a bunch of tribes. And if you didn't have men to defend your tribe, then another tribe would come along and just like kill all the men, rape all the women, and enslave your children and take all your food and take all your stuff, right? So you had to kind of, it was kill or be killed 100% all the time. And that's what led to a lot of the development of weapons and everything else in Europe, like in the savagery. Some of what we see as savagery was kind of built on this sort of need to survive, you know, in a really hostile environment. And so ultimately, that's one of the things I just kind of learned a long time ago that really helped me a lot. So I learned very, you know, very early, I'd say, that the world isn't going to feel sorry for you. Like people aren't going to, you know, like you can sit around and be like, oh, my God, white people are so mean to me. They hurt my feelings and they called me names and they beat me up and took my money. And people are just going to look at you like you're crazy. If they look at you like you're stupid, they're like, well, what did you do? Did you hit them back? You know, like, and so they might be like, oh, so you must be an inferior species. You must not be a grown-up. You must not be ready. Like maybe you're a child, or maybe your men really aren't men. Maybe your men are just little girls. Like because where we come from, the men defend themselves. They defend the community. They watch over the children. In fact, there was there's a really good movie, the Sopranos movie that just came out, and I was watching it with my wife. And there was a part where there's a brother who was basically taking on the Italians like head on. And the other Black man was like, man, you can't take on the Italians. The Italians, they got soldiers. They got soldiers. They'll come get you. They'll come kill you if you take their territory. And he said to his friend, he said, well, ain't you a soldier? And his friend said, well, no, I never thought of myself that way. And he said, well, you better start changing your thinking, right? You know, and that's really it, right? Like, if you think about, like, I think that we have an easy time visualizing another community where, you know, where the men will step out and defend and protect what's theirs, right? Like Dr. Claude Anderson talks about like the Cuban community in in Florida, in Miami, and how the Iranians tried to come in and just set up businesses in their community. And the Cubans were like, you're not going to do that. We're not allowing you to do that. Like, we will beat you up and kill you if you come and try to do that. And then, you know, and not to say that I would condone killing anybody or and all that other stuff, but I think that just that desire to defend and stand up, I think is something that somehow that was like knocked out of a lot of us. Right. And it is, and it's something where I know for myself, it got to the point where I just knew I had to have a certain amount of audacity and stop caring what people think. Right. Like, I gave up a long time ago on trying to be seen as a nice guy. Right. I realized, I said, okay, you could be a nice guy and be a sucker, or you could be a guy who's not nice all the time and be a winner. And or there's that other saying I heard where I think Angela Yee put this on her Twitter and I liked it. And it said, I'd rather be hated than be a hater. So, you know, for us, I think that's the choice. Like, what do you want to be? You want to be a hater or you want to be hated? You know, personally, I'm okay with being hated. I'm okay with people being mad at me and saying, boy's a bastard. But at the end of the day, my people going to eat, period. You know, and whatever that means, you know, then it's going to mean what it's going to mean. Okay. So anyway, I'm going to get out of here, guys. It was fun talking to you. And so don't forget, the All Black National Convention is coming up. I hope you guys will join us in the weekend of October 29th through November 1st. We are meeting in Orlando, Florida, and we are solution oriented. We've gathered over 40 Black experts, but it's also not just it's not just all work. It's going to be a lot of fun. We are having a B1 ball. We're having an awards show. We're going to give out things like the Lifetime Achievement Award, Man of the Year, Woman of the Year, Black Business of the Year, Youth Leader of the Year, you know, things like that. And we're also going to have a backyard barbecue, speed dating, a lot of fun. It's a great resort. It's got 9 restaurants. It's very first class. Like, it's not like, Renee, I hope you'll do more than consider it. If you come down there, find me and I will give you a double hug, Renee, because I would love to meet you in person. And I'll tell you, this is the kind of thing where I'm determined to do this because I'm tired of other people sort of feeling like they can just do what they want to us and tell us what to do and act like we have no say in any of this. Like, we've got our own geniuses. We've got our own men. We've got our women that are second to none. We've got our own children to protect. They belong to us, not to anybody else. So we must occupy their thinking before anybody else does. Dr. Christina Parks is going to be there. She recently confirmed that she's coming. And, you know, she's the sister that did that great testimony in the Michigan House of Representatives that everybody was talking about. But we're not necessarily anti or pro when it comes to the jab. So don't let that be a variable that determines whether or not you want to participate. We're not going to tell you what your beliefs should be. That's something that I believe in terms of how we need to conduct ourselves. I don't think we have to oppress anybody. I think it's really more so a matter of saying that whatever ideas we come up with, it's just got to come from us, you know, because a lot of your ideas and your thinking and the things you choose to do are just driven by whatever media is talking about or whatever somebody said, you know, and I'm not interested in that. I don't think that's beneficial to you at all. So that's it. So that's my pitch for the convention. I hope you guys will come out. And you can go to allblacknationalconvention.com to learn more. And by the way, we did make the you asked to make those B1 shirts. So there you go. So you can either buy them at the convention, or if you want to buy it before the convention or rock it at the convention, or just rock it without coming to the convention, you can actually go to wokeblacktees.com. So the URL is right there on the screen. So feel free to go pick up one of the shirts. We're doing it. We're getting it done. And I want to show you how serious we are. So I look forward to seeing you in person. So God bless you guys. Have a good night. Thank you for listening. This was fun. And I'll talk to you guys soon. Take care. Peace.